downtown. From live music and theater to gallery shows, festivals, and more. Catch it live on CFRC 101.9 FM, stream at cfrc.ca, or listen anytime on the CFRC Podcast Network. The Kingston Curator, your backstage pass to Kingston's creative scene.
Hello and good morning, everyone. You are listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the basement of Carruthers Hall, Kingston, Ontario, Canada. It is now Thursday, 11 a.m. My name is Rue, and you're listening to the CFRC Live Sessions, a show where the Live Sessions crew brings you musical performances recorded here in CFRC Studio A by artists from Kingston, Canada, and now all around the world. This week in Studio A, we're joined by DJ and rave producer Rare, and I talk to him about his music, his influences, about rave etiquette and culture, and misconceptions around raving, and rave music in Kingston. You can find his music on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/rare as FCK. He just recently released a new track called 4 AM in the Junction, and you should be able to find that on his SoundCloud, so check that out. And you can find him on Instagram at vincepop_. If you'd like to keep up with what we at CFRC and the Live Sessions are doing, head to Instagram or YouTube. Our handle is CFRC Live Sessions, and you will also soon be able to find a video of this performance on our YouTube page, so look out for that. If you are someone who's interested in joining the Live Sessions crew, especially if you're someone who's interested in videography, but also if you're someone who wants to get involved with audio, interviewing, or any other aspect of the Live Sessions, you can reach out to me on Instagram, CFRC Live Sessions, or send an email to livesessions@cfrc.ca. Remember, CFRC is your campus and community station, so we welcome you. And if you're a musician, an artist who would like to get in touch to do a session at the station, again, reach out and we'll talk. If you appreciate the work that we do and you would like to show your support to our station and to this show and ensure that we can keep bringing you the best new artists that you need to be hearing up close and personable, consider donating to our 101-year-old station to help keep us going. You can head to cfrc.ca/donate to find out how to do so. If you're interested in sponsoring this show, CFRC Live Sessions, putting your name on it and saying that you were an early supporter of one of the coolest shows on a very, very cool station, and I say this every week, reach out again and we will talk. But for now, here's DJ Rare in session live at CFRC. Awesome. So we're here on CFRC 101.9 FM, CFRC Live Sessions. You're here with me, your host, Rue, and I'm joined today by Vince.
Hello. Nice to meet you. Actually, I go by Rare.
Okay.
Yes.
Cool.
Yes.
DJ Rare.
Yes. DJ Rare. Yes. DJ Rare. That works.
Okay.
Anything
perfect.
You'd like.
So DJ Rare joins us here, and we're gonna slightly lift the veil and look behind the curtains.
Yeah.
So Vince, tell us about how kind of you got into the rave music scene, because this is a little different from what we normally do.
Yeah. So it's actually been fairly recent for me, within the past 2 years, where I've kind of progress more into that world. EDM's always kind of been a big thing for me. I mean, everyone around Ottawa and Kingston area grew up listening to Skrillex and stuff like that, so that was always like a big influence per se in dubstep. But I think it kind of faded out in 2014, and then especially like Kingston area kind of got really poppy and really like hip-hoppy and sort of just stuck to its goals. So it kind of took me actually moving to Toronto and sort of versing myself in the events there and like the scene there. That's what sort of made me appreciate and have the love for I have now for it.
And then you just speak into your mind.
Yeah, sorry. It was mainly like moving to Toronto. The main thing was being able to see people go about these environments and these spaces so non-judgmentally, and I think that was sort of the main thing for me before music. It was the environments that these events created and sort of like the attitude that a lot of people give off at these events. It's very inclusive. It's very, everyone's welcome and like everyone's supposed to be here type of thing. Everyone's here to have a good time. And I think that's sort of where I latched on.
Mm-hmm.
That's always been my biggest thing, is I want to be able to have a good time with other people and everyone be all smiles. And yeah.
And to me, from the outside, because I'm clearly not really in the rave scene, but it does seem to me from the outside like it's one of the few kind of anonymous music spaces that's still left there, where it's not sort of like you don't have to know everybody's name, take a picture of everything. Even like locations of shows are often just completely unknown.
Yeah, that's like a big thing too, is renegade rave culture. And that's like, it's really the heart of rave culture. At the end of the day, like we are, rave culture is slowly kind of being eaten up by like capitalism and heavy price tickets and all of that. But at the end of the day, there are still the communities there, especially once you go to like a city like Toronto or Montreal. It's sort of, you really start to dig in and sort of find those little communities of few hundred people that are, they're making sure that the community has access to these things and has access to free events and cheaper events and, you know, all inclusive events. And yeah.
Is that sort of thing a little harder to do in Kingston? Because I feel like everything is super visible in Kingston because it's a slightly smaller place.
Yeah, so I definitely agree with you there that Kingston is one of those cities where, because of our population, I think because of our demographic as well, we're a university town mixed with a retirement city, so it's very hard.
The two extremes.
Yeah, it's the two extremes. That's a perfect way to put it. And it's really hard to sort of work around that, especially like as rave culture, because a lot of the older generation of Canada, they view rave culture as drug culture, unfortunately. And that's something that's, they do go two and two, but they aren't exclusively intertwined with each other. You know, like you can separate one from another. You don't have to. But unfortunately, that's sort of a big thing, is a lot of older people in this area specifically, and I've dealt with a lot of that, is anytime you say the word rave, it's just nope. Nope, nope, nope. That's drugs, and you know.
I remember I was talking to Kakao about this as well.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, his music isn't necessarily rave even, but it's just sort of like the electronic side.
Yeah, for sure.
But he also got pulled into a lot of that stuff.
And
it's, it's a lot more, like rave culture is a lot more than just, you know, drugs or whatever.
Yeah.
Like you said, it's not exclusive, but there's also a lot of other stuff. It's like this counterculture, it's queer culture, it's like this alternative, almost rebellious thing that's going on.
That's really the heart of it for me. Just like personally, it's always been rebellious queer culture. Like that's what it has come down to, is like it's something that is there to make people happy, and especially in the lowest points of their lives or where they don't have access to certain things or certain events or certain communities. That should always be there, you know what I mean? Like, it should always be an option. But yeah.
And I love that, like, every time I look at, like, rave scenes, you always just see the rules of rave are so clearly, like, enforced,
yes.
Right? That, you know, you don't mess with anybody, you respect everybody's spaces, you, like, you know, take care of people who are around you, and, you know, you don't film stuff, you keep everything as it's supposed to be.
For sure. I think that sort of stems from, like, the main thing in the rave community is called PLUR. Peace, love, unity, respect. That's sort of what a lot of people say at events. You'll just go up to someone and yell PLUR, you know, or whatever. It's really just an embodiment. Like, it's an attitude, really, that you have to bring to every one of these events and not even these events. Like, you can bring it everywhere with you in life. You should carry it everywhere. It's just, you know, peace, love, unity, respect. Have a smile for everyone around you type of thing.
Definitely.
But yeah.
And, you know, Kingston with this, like, small music scene, how do people get involved in, like, raves and things like that?
I think the biggest thing, it's tough to say at this point. I think if you actually want to verse yourself and see sort of all levels of the world, I think, or all levels of the rave world, I think that your best bet would honestly just be go take a weekend in Montreal and Toronto. You'll see the full verse of it. And not only that, you can bring that experience and information and knowledge that you've learned there back to your community. And I think that's what Kingston really needs, is everyone that is doing these things and they are traveling for these events and everything, because there are a lot of people in Kingston, like a lot of people who love these things. I think we just kind of have to instill that knowledge and information that we've taken from bigger cities and instill it here and sort of put our foot down and sort of, I really think the biggest thing is just putting yourself out there and just trying to meet like-minded people and seeing what you guys can create from yourselves.
Even the traveling aspect of it, like getting together, this community thing.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. Carpooling, whatever you need. Like, there's always some sort of way to get around. There's always going to be someone that'll help you in this community, for sure. It's all about reaching out to people and trying to find. That's the hardest part. Like, I really don't. You know, it's all about finding the people.
And in Kingston, are there, like, other artists in the scene that you've, like, been working with or, like, admire, performed with?
Yeah, so actually, my best friend here, Owen, he's a producer and DJ as well. We're both from Kingston area. He's sort of my main go-to for collaborations and all of that. Other than that, though, no, I think it's just mainly Owen. I know there's a few, like, Kakao I know of. There's a few other techno DJs as well and locally, but as of right now, it's kind of just, you know, I'm trying to see who we can meet and where we can go with it, but yeah.
And it's not really the stages scene.
No. I really try to separate my music and my sound from that whole sort of culture. I think a lot of the stages scene has sort of been enwrapped in like a lot of frat culture, and sort of, and that it kind of it butt heads with rave culture. Like frat culture and rave culture are kind of two different things. So, but yeah.
So musically, where do you draw from?
Oh God, a lot, everywhere. I draw like originally. My earliest listening, I was like a big Nirvana fan, but recently, like, I'm all over the place. I draw inspiration from people like Hunter Gex. I draw from people like 99 Jakes, Chief Keef, even like rappers, underground rap. XXXTentacion was a big one for me. Lil Peep was a big one for me. But now, no, there's even people like Chippy Nonstop in Toronto. There's a lot of great DJs and great producers coming out of Toronto, Montreal currently, that are really stepping it up and like pushing Canada's scene internationally. But yeah.
That's awesome. And you're going to do a set for us today.
Yes.
And it's just going to be one long set, right?
Yes, I'm going to do one little 20-30 minute set for you and get it over and done with.
Okay, perfect. So, like, where can people find you later on and, like, go to your shows,
yep,
keep up with stuff you're releasing?
So, as of now, mainly I'm on SoundCloud. Just search Rare as FCK on SoundCloud. Same as Instagram. You can find me at Vince Pop on Instagram. I don't have any local shows currently planned, but I definitely hope to have something planned for Pride and get something going, something small and fun. But
okay.
Yeah.
That sounds fun.
Keep an eye out for Pride event.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And do you have any releases and things like that coming up?
Yes, I actually have a Snow Strippers remix of Hurt So Good coming out in about 2 weeks. And then next week I should have an original single called 4 AM in the Junction coming out next week.
Okay, perfect. So we could maybe even just air this next week.
Yeah,
that could
totally
work.
Sure, for sure.
But for now, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank
Vince
you.
Rare.
Yes.
Let's go into your set.
Awesome, thank you very much.
Here on C-Pussy.
Well, slap me, silly. Is it that time again? If you're ready to get sweaty, sexy, and rave, turn that volume up, queen. You're listening to Rare as FCK on 101.9 FM. Stay rare.
Seven, six, five, four, three, two, one.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Rare, and you're listening to CFRC on 101.9 FM. Don't stop listening.
Hello and welcome to this new edition of Viewpoints on today's show. The Canada-wide science fair pulls in hundreds of teenagers making novel uses of AI.
I created a portable AI ultrasound that you can bring to remote communities and basically find cancer earlier and save more lives.
Some BC journalists are raising funds to bring back a local news outlet, while the historic New Brunswick Courier newspaper is being relaunched in printed and electronic form.
We got the ball rolling. The community got involved. A community member by the name of Geekru helped us acquire a grant to help print that paper. And so the only thing that's new about it, I guess, is the name and the fact that it's now free.
The organizers of a two-day bike-a-thon managed to keep thousands of riders safe through the southern Ontario smog.
Survived. I'm a survivor. I gotta be happy, man. You know, I can breathe. I'm here. They cured me. You know, it's incredible.
Dozens of Canadians will march to Gaza as part of a global peace effort. 3,000 people from around the globe will meet in Egypt. Jeff Houlihan, a St. John's University professor, will be joining a delegation of Montrealers.
The question of feed the children of Gaza versus to starve the children of Gaza is not a political one. It's a question of right and wrong. And if we are in a place where we believe that that is a political question, then we've completely lost our way.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Hello and welcome, Boris Hassan, with you for the next 30 minutes, taking you to Montreal, St. John, New Brunswick, Cobourg, Ontario, and Toronto. Our first stop will be in Quebec, as a group of Montrealers will travel to Egypt to participate in the Global March to Gaza on June 15. They'll join some 3,000 people from around the world in Cairo. They'll first begin their journey in Arish in the north and then on foot towards Rafah, around 50 kilometers away. The demonstration is calling on Israel to open the Gazaian border and allow free entry of humanitarian aid. Israel blocked aid for 11 weeks this year, and aid flows still remain extremely limited. Safa Chebi and Baya El Hashimi are two of the Montrealers joining the march. They told Jules Brugiel in Montreal that the crisis in Gaza compelled them to act however they could. Please note that this story was first aired on June 13th, 2 days before the event.
Dozens of Canadians will travel to Egypt for June 15th's Global March to Gaza. They'll join at least 2,000 others from around the world in Cairo, beginning a journey first to El Arish in the north and then on foot toward Rafah, around 50 kilometers away. They're demanding that Israel open the border and cease their blockade of international aid.
People have decided that enough is enough. Our government's aren't reacting accordingly. There's a genocide that's ongoing. There are people are being killed on a daily basis by Israel, you know.
Zahia El-Masri is part of the Montreal chapter of Labour for Palestine. They're one of the roughly 80 organizations supporting the Canadian contingent, which organizers say numbers between 75 and 120 people. El Masri was speaking at a press conference in Montreal on Thursday, alongside some of the participants in next week's march.
You have over, I think, 60 countries that are participating today, and people are raising their own money. You know, they're, you know, putting their jobs aside, their families. You have here mothers that bent over backwards, you know, to find daycare, to find friends, to stay with their kids while they're going to go and try to march onto Gaza to break this blockade. This is humanity at its best.
Groups like Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and Doctors Without Borders have called the war in Gaza a genocide, though Israel has contested that label. The Gaza Health Ministry has reported almost 57,000 people killed since October 7th. The World Health Organization says the population is at risk of famine as well. Israel blocked international aid for 11 weeks this year. Starting in May, shipments must now come through the U.S. and Israel-backed Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, replacing hundreds of UN distribution sites with only three, one of which remains closed. Israeli forces killed 27 aid seekers at one such facility on Tuesday.
Not acting is something like I can't conceive it.
Safa Shabi is one of the Montrealers traveling to Egypt next week for the march. She told CKUT she's had mixed reactions from her friends and family since telling them the news.
For sure, at first it seems crazy. For me, it's not crazy. It's crazy to just keep watching without doing nothing. And for me, it's impossible to do it.
For Baya El Hashmi, the question is not why she's joining the march, it's how others can see the images of violence and starvation and not try to act.
Comment ils font pour effacer ces images-là? Comment faites-vous pour continuer avec your daily life? How can you do it? Je ne comprends pas. Moi, j'en peux plus.
The director of a Montreal NGO supporting single moms, she says her decision has led to tough conversations with her own daughters, who don't want their mother to be a martyr.
C'est clair, quand tu as en face de toi ton enfant qui te dit « Maman, j'ai peur, tu t'en vas dans une zone de guerre, j'ai beau expliquer, c'est ça qui résonne, même si elle est capable de comprendre des choses. » C'est clair que je ne suis pas insensible à la peur de mes enfants et puis aux sentiments qui les habitent en ce moment. La décision a été prise très rapidement, mais en même temps, c'est mon choix. Elles l'ont accepté. Elles n'ont pas le choix.
She says it's a choice she's making for her daughters too, so that they can live in a better world and one in which they feel empowered to act.
Puis on n'est pas plus courageux que d'autres. On n'est pas plus vaillant que d'autres. On n'est pas plus intelligent que les autres. On a toutes et tous la possibilité d'agir. Le pas tir, c'est plus une option.
Organizers say the Canadian delegation has already met with the Egyptian consulate and are being supported by NGOs on the ground. Still, they and other delegations will have to negotiate with Egyptian authorities to cross over the border into Gaza. For CKUT, I'm Jules Bijal with the Local Journalism Initiative.
Since the war began, some estimates report that over 50,000 Gazans have been killed and over 100,000 injured in what has been described as a genocide by South Africa. A United Nations Special Committee and Amnesty International, alongside other human rights organizations. One of the participants in the Global March to Gaza is one of New Brunswick's UNB Professor of Biological Sciences, Jeff Houlihan. Houlihan spoke about the march and its aims, as well as his reasons for participating.
We do occasionally get this question of, you know, why Egypt? Like, why are you protesting there? And it's because it's at that border in Rafah, the border between Egypt and Gaza, where the trucks are piling up. You know, you've got people around the world that are donating money to Red Crescent and Red Cross, and all of that money is being used to buy food and medical aid that is now sitting rotting at the border. It's spoiling at the border. We want to bring attention directly to this issue of starving the people of Gaza. And the question of feed the children of Gaza versus to starve the children of Gaza is not a political one. It's a question of right and wrong. And if we are in a place where we believe that that is a political question, then we've completely lost our way.
That was just a clip from Yonako's interview with Jeff Houlihan. The complete story is on frequencynews.ca. We'll meet up with Yona later in this show.
You're on the air with Viewpoints.
Time to take some fresh air now, as more than 4,500 cyclists showed up on June 7th to begin a two-day bike ride to help raise funds for cancer research. The event almost didn't happen because of the worst air quality that Toronto had ever experienced on June 4th. Thousands of cyclists, including many cancer survivors, were hanging on the edge of their seats to get the green light as Canada's largest athletic fundraiser, the 18th annual Ride to Conquer Cancer, hosted by the Princess Margaret Cancer Foundation, was scheduled to take place. As you probably guessed, organizers still made it happen on short notice. The ride went on, breaking a new record of $20.6 million in support of life-saving cancer research. Here's Mia Johnson in Toronto.
A cycling event aiming to raise funds for cancer research. This is the foundation's 18th annual bike ride to conquer cancer. The average 100K two-day bike ride began in Toronto, ending for the first time in Niagara-on-the-Lake this year. More than 4,000 riders showed up to participate, many of whom are cancer survivors.
Survived. I'm a survivor. I gotta be happy, man. You know, I can breathe. I'm here. They cured me. You know, it's incredible. So it's amazing.
The 61-year-old cancer survivor Stan Raimondo, who lives in Toronto, has been doing this ride since its onset.
For a long time. This is my 18th ride. So my goal, believe it or not, I'm a survivor for 20 years. I want to do this ride for 50 years to show that somebody can survive and do it. So I'll be 93. How old are you?
23.
You might be the one pulling me when I'm 93.
So. Good hope so. Air quality alerts eased in Ontario after days of prairies wildfire haze, just in time for the country's largest athletic fundraiser on Saturday morning. A communication was sent out to all riders then with instructions on how to proceed safely. Bailey says the foundation staff consulted health and weather experts to decide the best course of action.
We're a part of the bigger puzzle here and logistics team behind the scenes. But we do have a logistics team, and then we also have a health and safety team in Odyssey Medical that is in touch with meteorologists, has a lot more in-depth information and behind-the-scenes information on tracking that allows us to make decisions in real time and have a very good sense. So, you know, we started to have conversations the last few days around risk mitigation.
Bailey said had the air quality index been above range for a safe ride, the foundation would have been forced to cancel the event.
So, you know, we would have been as creative as we could have possibly been to ensure that we got as much of the ride in as we possibly could have. We may have, if it was out of range or too high in the index, we may have had to make the decision to ultimately cancel the event too.
The escalation of external risks has taken a toll on other long-standing bike marathons across the country. The BC Cancer Foundation, for example, made the decision to cancel their 16-year bike ride in October after facing challenges. For four of the past six rides, participants helmed extreme heat, smoke, and rain events.
But it's becoming more and more the norm, right? I mean, as the event gets bigger and grows and becomes more prominent, more and more people are participating. We want to do, first and foremost, we are a cancer charity and we're a health fundraiser. And the last thing we want to do is compromise anyone's health and safety. So.
This is Mia Johnson with the Local Journalism Initiative.
Hi, I'm Pamela Hassan in Smithers, BC, and you are listening to Viewpoints.
Our next stop will be out east to tell you about the 2025 Canada-wide Science Fair. Hundreds of finalists of provincial and territorial science fairs met up to showcase their most recent science projects. But this year's edition, hosted by the University of New Brunswick, had quite a different flavor. Rennie Barlow, Executive Director of Youth Science Canada, which runs the event, noted a significant increase in the number of projects using AI and machine learning. Journalist Aidan Keenan, working out of Fredericton, was on location and brought this back to us.
Last week, from June 1st to June 6th, the University of New Brunswick hosted the Canada-wide Science Fair, a national event put on by Youth Sciences Canada. This year marks the fourth time that the fair has been hosted in Fredericton. Among the 390 students from all 10 provinces and 3 territories who attended, 15 were from New Brunswick, 5 of whom came from the Fredericton area. Rennie Barlow, the executive director of Youth Science Canada, explained what the Canada-wide Science Fair is and how those 390 students were selected.
Well, the Canada-wide Science Fair is the pinnacle of the STEM projects network that takes place across the country. There are approximately 100 regional STEM fairs across Canada in every province and territory, and they bring together about 20,000 students and their projects, and out of that they select the 339 projects and 390 students who are here at the National Fair to compete for the sort of recognition as having the best STEM projects in the country.
Those students competed for nearly $1.3 million worth of awards and scholarships. Heijin Wang, a student from St. John, New Brunswick, took home a platinum award, meaning the judges felt that her project, titled Controlling Humongous Fungus, Cyanobacteria as a Biocontrol Agent for Root Rot Fungus, was among the best in its category. However, Rennie noted a rising trend across all projects at the fair this year.
We have a lot of projects, for example, that are making use of artificial intelligence or machine learning, you know, with access to that through the internet. You know, many of these finalists are self-taught in terms of using those tools, and so that is really growing. They're looking at doing things like image analysis to perhaps diagnose disease, or we have projects in robotics. We have projects that are very much pure science, investigating the causes of various things, why things work, why things happen the way they do. So it covers the whole range.
This year's shift towards AI-based projects seems to follow a wider trend in schools. Here are Trudy McNeil and Amanda Boutlier, who are both science teachers at Harold Peterson Middle School in Oromocto.
Compared to the last time we were here, where there might have been one or two, there was a lot of AI-based projects this year that are using AI for diagnosing like illnesses, and it kind of boggles the mind that these are high school students that are creating these things. So those really stood out to me.
So we both go to Learn East, which happens in New Brunswick for teachers every August. We've been going for a few years now, and last year, 2024 session was all about AI, and it was phenomenal. And I would say within the last 2 years are when our students started showing some initiative and some knowledge about AI and what it can do, and certainly how you can use it to cheat on projects and things like that, which all goes along with the job. We teach them how to use it to their advantage, but not cheating on anything, making it work for you.
Joel Amaldus, a grade 10 student from Calgary, is a shining example of innovative AI use among the projects at this year's Canada-wide Science Fair.
I created a portable AI ultrasound that you can bring to remote communities and basically find cancer earlier and save more lives. I took the basics of those large ultrasound machines and created it into a small compact device, which basically takes an image, and then after that, it sends it to a device that has my AI running on it. Turned on thousands of images of breast and liver and thyroid images, so it can find exactly where your tumor is in a matter of seconds, like less than 5 seconds.
And was that kind of the result that you expected, or did it even surprise you?
Yeah, it kind of surprised me that it could find it so quickly, but also so accurately. Like, I have an accuracy of 98.1%.
Joel's project received a bronze medal from the judges. Students from Fredericton were also well represented at the fair. Here's Ritika Gawa, a grade 11 student at Fredericton High School.
So my project is about an enzyme called matrix metalloproteinase 2, and what it does is that it eats the collagen in our bodies. So I looked at its activation in transgenic zebrafish scales. So the first part of my project was to see if there's actually activation in zebrafish scales, because this is the first time this has been done. And then the next part of my experiment was to use different types of treatments to see how this enzyme is affected. So two out of my three treatments came out to be insignificant, but there was one that did come out to be significant, so I was happy about that.
Some students, like Leah Coakley, another FHS student in grade 12, combined athletics with science.
My project focuses on building injury prevention programs for female soccer players and determining which exercises are better for different phases of injury prevention and rehabilitation. I've noticed that there's been a lot of lacking research on calf muscles, especially since they're so important in the sport of soccer, since there's so much running that athletes have to do and their calves are placed under so much stress. And I'm also going into kinesiology at UMB Fredericton, so really interested in learning about this before I get to my studies.
Other students took on projects with wider ecological and economic implications. Here's Harshu Vardhani Metakumar, a grade 8 student at the Montgomery Street Middle School in Fredericton.
My project is on bioplastics and how I created my own bioplastic bag prototypes to hopefully replace traditional plastics in the future. So as we know, with like the plastic pollution crisis, we're told we have to stop using plastics or that we have to stop producing them. But the basic truth is that we simply can't, because plastics are everywhere, including like the clothes that we're wearing. So the only viable and reliable solution that we have to the plastic pollution crisis is replacing them with bioplastics. What I ended up doing was I set a certain criteria that my bioplastic prototypes had to follow in order for them to meet the same industrial level as traditional plastics. So my bioplastic had to be produced with a straightforward process and in a certain time frame. My bioplastic had to be pretty durable and then economic efficiency, so it had to be cheap to produce, because as we know, plastics are very cheap, which is why most companies would prefer plastics compared to bioplastics. I then moved on to creating my first prototype. I want to highlight three main ingredients, so gelatin, which was the base, pectin, which provided the structural components, and then glycerin, which provided elasticity. And I found that my second prototype was the most successful, and it held up to 1 kg. That's comparable to obviously traditional plastics.
Trudy summed up the importance of events like the Canada-wide Science Fair and the ways that these projects look towards the future.
I mean, these kids are top-notch on the projects they've done and what they're presenting. And as I walked around, every time I come, as I walk around, I just think, I needed this. This renews my hope for the future, because the kids here today are our future. The robotics that they are creating will be used for medical advancement someday, and biodegrading plastic and reducing plastic waste in our oceans, and everything that we need on this planet, they're working on it right now, which is fascinating and uplifting.
That was Aidan Keenan, his complete story on frequencynews.ca. We stay out east. The Courier newspaper, first printed in Charlotte County in 1865, has just been relaunched. St. Andrews-based CHCO-TV has now taken over ownership of the historic New Brunswick newspaper, and the new owners have started a pilot project to print the Courier as a free monthly newspaper. They had first launched a new online version of the paper late last year. Natalie Sturgeon, the new editor of the Courier, spoke to our St. John-based journalist Yona Koh about the relaunch. They discussed the paper's reception from local readers and the importance of independent local media.
CHCO-TV is very passionate about local news and offering that to the people of Charlotte County, so we explored the option of acquiring the paper. We heard from a lot of people when we launched our website about, you know, if you ever print again or if you want to start a subscription base, we'd be happy to do that. And so we got the ball rolling. The community got involved. A community member by the name of Guy Grew helped us acquire a grant to help print that paper. And so the only thing that's new about it, I guess, is the name and the fact that it's now free.
You alluded to the fact that the community was kind of involved in this. Why is this important for the people of Charlotte County that the Courier exists for a start, but that it's being printed again?
Well, not everybody is digitally friendly, right? We have to recognize that there are people who have limitations, but also we've printed it with a little bit bigger font. We've kind of given that access to folks because we think that it's important that everybody has access to news and information. And in an era when news and information is getting harder to come by, especially through social media, we wanted it to be so important. But the community has kind of responded in a way I think we sort of expected they would, but it's kind of been overwhelming. They're very excited about it. The paper is kind of flying off the shelves in a way that we weren't expecting. We're almost out of papers, to be honest with you. I think there's only about 800 or 900 left, so out of a print of about 3,000, I think. So the response has been really important, but the community, you know, voiced that they wanted a print version, and so we had to kind of explore that option and look at how we keep it sustainable throughout the process.
In terms of the kind of importance of the paper itself and its legacy, I suppose I did want to kind of ask a little bit about the history of it.
The first Courier was printed 2 years before Confederation, so this paper has a really long history in Charlotte County and in New Brunswick. So it was here when things were first getting started. It was kind of the first draft of the history of this corner of the province. So it was very important to continue that legacy for us, because news is more important now than ever. And actually, when we were printing for the first time, we went to the Charlotte County Archives and we actually got to see the first ever front page of the Courier from 1865. So if you pick up a copy, you'll see that first edition from 1865. So that was important to us to continue its legacy of the cornerstone of democracy.
Broadly speaking, what is the importance of independent news sources in today's media landscape?
Well, you know, the independent part is very important, but it's also news deserts, right? There are places across this country, not in just New Brunswick, that don't have any form of news or information. And so we've decided this nonprofit model is the best way to effectively deliver journalism, because every dollar that we get from community donations or grants goes back into operating the television station and the newspaper. And so it allows us, you know, that capacity to be free for folks and to provide information in a timely manner and in the way that they desire, which was in a printed paper. So it's very important that we exist in these places, and I think that we've done a very good job of providing that accurate news source for folks here in Charlotte County.
In terms of its continuation in the printed form and the frequency of publication, I mean, is this the model going ahead?
Well, so it's a pilot project for right now. We have enough to kind of do it for 12 months, and then we have to look forward to the future about how do we keep it sustainable, right? We are, as I mentioned, a nonprofit model, so we have to kind of find that break-even moment for us where it's not costing us to print the paper, but we're getting enough advertising to kind of keep it afloat and keep it free. So it's important to us that we're not only able to continue to print, and we'll review that when the time comes, but also to keep it free and accessible for folks so that they don't need to pay for their news and information. So that's really what we'll be looking at the scope. So for now, we have 12 months, and then in the future, we'll take a look at how we keep it sustainable enough to keep printing it.
In terms of the future and the sort of the media landscape as it stands at the moment, I mean, what are your hopes in terms of survivability in general of print media?
You have to want it to survive, and I think our model is one that other areas across this country should be looking at, because not only are we running a television station with four people, but we're also now operating a newspaper and we're printing a newspaper. And I think this model needs to be explored elsewhere by other places in the country, because it really does work. Not only are we surviving in a media landscape that is kind of tumultuous right now, but we're thriving in doing so. So I think this is a model that needs to be looked at elsewhere, and I think it's the future of journalism, given what we know about that corporate nature and things like that. You know, we're grateful to the community for their support. Journalism is not always the most appreciated industry in the world, especially given today's, landscape. So we were really appreciative of the support that our community has given us for people who don't live here full time, but have reached out and are hoping to grab a copy. We're just so tremendously grateful for the support that's been shown to us. We're so happy to hear that people are so excited about it.
This is Iona Cove, the Local Journalism Initiative.
And just a footnote to let you know that a fundraising campaign has been launched at the other end of the country in British Columbia to bring back a local news outlet for New Westminster, Tri-Cities and Burnaby. The goal is to collect $100,000. That story by Danny Nesvedarani can be found at frequencynews.ca. And that's it for us. Thanks to our journalists this week, Yona Ko, Mia Johnson, Aidan Keenan, and Jules Bugiel. Our national editors are Conrad Fox and Victoria Fenner. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Thanks again for being with us this week, and until the next, enjoy your